You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 6th of April 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, British Prime Minister Theresa May welcomes European Council President Donald Tusk for the first of approximately 3 million Brexit-related meetings, which everyone is subsequently going to pretend were amicable and constructive. My guests Sir William Patey and Raffaello Pantucci will be here to discuss that and the day's other top stories, including the never-easy relationship between Saudi Arabia and the West. What does each still need from each other? In Washington, an apparent demotion for Trump's Geppetto, Steve Bannon, and a retreat from another ally, Devin Nunes. Do we even understand what any of this even means anymore? And yet another, by which we mean a second national leader in the last 3 months alone, wades into the eternally roiling controversy about pineapple on pizza. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. Welcome to the show. My guests today are Sir William Patey, International Affairs Advisor at Control Risks and former British Ambassador to Sudan, Iraq, Saudi Arabia and Afghanistan, and Raffaello Pantucci, Director of International Security Studies at the Royal United Services Institute. Welcome both. And we will start here in London, where UK Prime Minister Theresa May has hosted European Council President Donald Tusk to formally begin what will be, at the very least, 2 years of complex, tedious, expensive and inevitably rancorous Brexit negotiations, which will, if all concerned are unfeasibly fortunate, leave neither the UK nor the EU much the worse off than they presently are. Sir William, first of all, the official word on these discussions that they have been is that they have been positive, in inverted commas. Now, translated from diplo speak into English, what does positive mean? That is presumably not as bad as full and frank exchange of views.
Full and frank is a full out argument. Positive probably means what it says. They had a good exchange. I mean, Donald Tusk is probably one of the most sympathetic of the EU interlocutors we'll deal with, certainly more than Juncker or Barnier or Verstappen. So he genuinely, you know, is sorry that Britain is going and will want a deal that is as good for Europe as it can be, and not overly bad for Britain. So those two together, I think, are probably, you know, I'm not surprised they had positive discussions.
Raffaello, I was struck by Tusk's notably monosyllabic response to subsequent press questions. He basically just says no to every question he was asked, apart from replying as always when he was asked if the talks had gone well. You don't need to be too bright to decipher, I guess, the subtext there. Has the UK underestimated the degree to which, because obviously this is going to be a colossal pain in the neck for the United Kingdom, but at least the United Kingdom voted for this colossal pain in the neck, whereas how much resentment do we think there is among the 27 other EU countries that they are going to be put through this?
Well, I think that's quite substantial. I think a lot of them, for many different reasons, are very agitated about what's happening and the consequences of it, both to the union, both to their and to their individual sort of interests. But then I also wonder, and this is maybe I wonder why we get such a sort of non-response from him at this public meeting, is the determination within the EU about who's actually going to be the front man talking on this. I mean, Barnier is the one who's been given the job, right? And so he's the one who's actually managing this process. And so is he always going to be the one who they're going to put out front? At the end of the day, you're going to have this perennial problem within the EU of ultimately having a negotiation where you've got one person on one side and 27 or 28 really on the other. And which of those actually is the voice that you should be listening to? And I suspect that in this sort of early stage of the formal negotiations actually taking place, on the EU side, there's going to be a lot of questioning about, well, okay, so who is the lead? Who is the one who we should be talking to and leading on and listen to when you have these sorts of public discussions?
I mean, they're going to want to keep as much of this as private as they can, but they're not going to be able to. But so I'm not surprised that they're a bit reticent, because they've seen sort of the reactions of the British press to every nuance of this, you know, whether it's Gibraltar or whether it's something somebody says.
Gibraltar, which we were briefly at war over for about 48 hours at the weekend.
Yes, I think wiser heads have prevailed. I see Peter Hain has reminded us that we almost had a deal over joint sovereignty in 2002, but the Spanish rejected it. It may be time to revive that.
We are seeing some cracks in the carapace of secrecy they are trying to erect over this thing. William, what do you make of Theresa May's apparent somewhat hesitant softening on freedom of movement? She's suggesting that there will be a transitional arrangement in place, possibly some people are suggesting till as late as 2020 or 2022.
Well, I suspect she's hearing the cries of all the people in the National Health Service and the service industry who realise that actually most of these migrants from the EU are performing much needed functions, and a transition arrangement might be good for us to be able to replace them all. In 2 years is not going to happen, and hopefully we'll have a deal which EU nationals who are already here will be able to stay, but there'll also be a need for continual refreshment over the next few years. We can't replace all these people very easily.
How much trouble, Raffaello, is she going to have selling this politically, domestically? Because leaving aside all the other nonsense that went on during the referendum campaign, it was a vote on immigration, wasn't it? People, by and large, who voted leave because they think there are too many foreigners in Britain.
Well, I think it's a mix. I mean, I think if we look at the sort of polling...
That was a pretty big aspect.
No, it was a major theme. There's no doubt about it. But I question sometimes, because if you look at some of the polling afterwards about why people voted, they did seem to come up with all sorts of different reasons. And yes, migration was a sort of major one, and it certainly was a major political one in the sort of public debate. But I wonder a little bit. But I think your bigger point about, you know, it was... whatever the individual motivations of every single voter were, it was a clear theme of the whole conversation. What's fascinating to me is how much they've already kind of walked back on it. We've had David Davis in sort of Parliament already talking about the fact that, you know, actually migration numbers probably aren't going to go down for a very long time. And, you know, all sorts of things have already been sort of walked back on that. But that, to me, is really become one of these things about the whole Brexit debate, which is so obvious, but also we seem to be moving on from quite quickly. It doesn't seem to, you know, that we do get a lot of anger, mostly from Remainers, who will say, you know, oh, well, hang on, this is another example of her, these sort of mendacious lies that were used during the vote. And the reality of it is very different. But the public seems very happy to sort of move on from these issues very quickly.
I don't know. I think there is a plurality of sort of leave ultras who once they realise that nobody is, you know, rounding up Latvians and sort of putting them on boats and sending them back home are going to be incredibly angry.
Well, I'm not sure. I think they'll be able to do something which will assuage the worst excesses of the Daily Express and the Daily Mail on things like benefits and in-work credits and all of that. You can still have a transition period with all the EU people who are here in employment, but you can have some adjustments to some of the more egregious benefits claims, which were always exaggerated. But if the government could do something on that to fend off what I would call the backwoodsmen in their own party. And, you know, and actually people are turning up at their NHS. I've spoken to a lot of people recently who've had recent experience of the NHS, and people are counting the number of Europeans or non-Brits who've treated them, and it's usually 7 out of 8.
Right. Well, just thinking of my own local GP practice, if all the foreign employees of it were removed, I think it would be a fairly empty building. We will have at least 2 years further to discuss the ins and outs of Brexit, of course, which is well worth staying alive for. So that being the case, we will move on to Theresa May's other recent exercise in diplomatic outreach. The Prime Minister visited Saudi Arabia this week, a task which presents challenges on the optics front for any leader of a democracy, arguably more so for a female one. The argument is, of course, as old as Britain's relationship with Saudi Arabia is: the general awfulness of the Riyadh regime at home and abroad, balanced by its commercial and strategic value to Britain. Raffaello, is it?
I mean, I think it's a very difficult balance, quite frankly. And I think it's a country which has all sorts of problems. And I think some of what we're seeing happen in Yemen is clearly very problematic. But I think Saudi Arabia has always been a very important ally to the United Kingdom in both commercial and strategic terms. And there has to be something said for that. So, you know, I think that it's one of these very difficult balances that the PM is always going to face, or any PM in the UK is going to face, in terms of a relationship with a country that is very important, but at the same time bears all sorts of problems.
So, William, you were, of course, the ambassador to Riyadh. On the occasion where a British Prime Minister or any other Western leader visits, how How wedded are Saudi officialdom seriously to the religious protocols, especially? Because Theresa May, of course, did not cover her head on this visit. Are the Saudis basically okay with that? Do they realise that that would have been politically absolutely impossible for her from a domestic perspective and just sort of wave it off and realise that's how the world works? Or are they? Is there a measure of genuine affront?
No, there's no affront at all. They realise that they don't want to impose their particular dress codes on visitors. So it's never been a problem with visiting prime ministers. Indeed, when Margaret Thatcher came to Saudi Arabia, Saudi Arabia was less open to women than they are now, but she was just treated as an ordinary man. There'll be no offence taken because Theresa May isn't covering her head. They're perfectly attuned to how other people act and dress.
But what is Riyadh's view of the relationship? From their point of view, why is there a relationship with the West actually useful to them?
Well, the broader West, they were for many, many years dependent on the US strategic alliance. So you remember Saudi Arabia was threatened by Saddam Hussein, and the United States and its allies, including Britain, came to their defence. So it's been a fundamental pillar of their security relationship with the West. Indeed, the reason they buy so many arms from the United States, from Britain and France, is because they think those are the countries who are more likely to defend them if they were attacked. So it's a strategic relationship for them. For us, it's economically very advantageous to us. We sell a lot more to Saudi Arabia than we import, and we have tens of thousands of Brits earning a perfectly good living in Saudi Arabia. So it's a balance that is good for all of us. And if we only did business with people who we had shared values, that would be a very narrow group of people.
If perhaps Britain could give some thought to joining some sort of free trade bloc of nations with which they share values. I don't know. It's just an idea.
Well, like the European Union.
Raffaello, the same relationship looked at from the other point of view. Again, it's that other sort of column A versus column B thing. We are frequently told, or at least people attempt to persuade us, that Saudi Arabia provides us with vital intelligence about terrorism, which we would not otherwise have. There's also fairly persuasive argument that Saudi Arabia also provides us with terrorism that we wouldn't otherwise have. Do we really know whose side they're actually on?
I mean, it's a really difficult question, because you're entirely right that, you know, when you look at some of the individuals who have sort of been radicalized and been very influential in the sort of global jihadist movement that has caused so much death and misery, it does undoubtedly have a footprint that is often leading back to Riyadh. And that is something that in many ways the Saudis continue to sort of have some influence over in terms of the sort of relationships that they have with some of these groups around the world. It's a very difficult balance, and I don't know that there is a sort of perfect way forwards on it. The point I would sort of look at is that while we can focus very much on that and trying to strike that sort of difficult balance, it's one that at the moment in some ways we have some leverage on, because they clearly want us as sort of allies to support them and work with them. I would look at China and say, look at the Chinese relationship with Saudi Arabia that's becoming increasingly influential and strong. And the Saudis are major consumers of Saudi oil. And I think recently there was the announcement made that they're going to build a drone factory. The first sort of Chinese drone factory being built outside the country is going to be developed in Saudi Arabia, which I think shows the growing sort of alignment there. And the question then becomes, at the moment, we have a relationship that to some degree we can exert some influence over this situation, because we're a very sort of important ally with them. What happens when they actually start to have very important, significant strategic alliances in security terms and economic terms with lots of other places? What happens to our leverage in that sort of a context?
William, that thing Raffaello mentions there, the idea of exerting influence, this comes up a lot when Western governments, Britain among them, are asked to justify doing business with the Saudi regime, about which, you know, there are any number of obvious complaints that can be reasonably made. This idea that we can encourage them to modernize, to reform, to moderate their behavior. Do the Saudis actually really care what the West thinks of them?
I think we've got to be realistic. Our influence is limited. You're talking about their way of life, their society. They're not going to change very much just because a bunch of Westerners tell them to. But you certainly have more influence if you engage than if you don't. I mean, if we were to disengage from Saudi Arabia, it would make no difference at all. I mean, I'm conscious of the fact that when we engage with the Saudis, we introduce forensic science and DNA testing into into their police investigations systems. That led to a very significant reduction in the normal methods of policing, which was to pick up the most likely suspect and beat a confession out of them. So you can actually have practical progress. But, you know, they're not going to listen to us about whether women can drive or not. They're going to listen to their own people. And although we can exhort them, in reality, we have very limited influence either way.
I mean, I understand the argument about how they'll change as and when they see fit, and you make more of a difference if you engage than if you don't. But again, and I realise there's probably realistic reasons why this would never happen. I'm playing devil's advocate slightly, but the world at large and the West certainly did disengage with South Africa in the 1980s when we decided that certain aspects of that regime's behaviour were beyond any context or beyond any excuse. In the admittedly unlikely event that such a sort of embargo was placed on Saudi Arabia, would it make any difference to them?
Well, there's no support for any such embargo.
I'm aware of that. I'm in cloud cuckoo land over here.
It might. And, you know, to compare Saudi Arabia's human rights record with an apartheid regime in South Africa is a little bit strong. Saudi Arabia shares with a lot of other countries a poor human rights record. It's not actually in the top 10, in my view. I know you're not allowed to compare these things, but, you know, the only thing that gives them the profile is the fact that women can't drive. I used to say to Prince Saud Al Faisal,
It's not just not driving that women can't do.
Well, but there has been progress now. 50% of university places in Saudi Arabia are occupied by women. Women are increasingly in the workplace. So there is change going on. But the absence of driving singles them out. They're the only country in the world where that happens. So it gives them an iconic status and puts them in the Premier League of human rights abusers, where I think they'd be relegated to the Championship if women were able to drive.
Raffaello, is there an issue, I guess, I don't know, is morally or legally the right word, with continuing to arm Saudi Arabia when we know what we know about what is occurring in Yemen? I mean, has the decision been taken there by Britain and the wider West? Well, there's not really anything we can do. If we don't sell them the weapon, someone else will. It's not really our problem, etc. Or has the West basically picked a side in what is, as you know, a wider proxy war between Riyadh and Tehran?
Well, I think what's fascinating to me in a way is that we do seem to have chosen a side, but at the same time, we don't. And there's a constant effort, for example, from a European perspective, to try to build relations with the Iranians, to sort of help the Iranians as they open up and try to engage with the economic potential there, which is definitely trying to engage with the other side of the sort of proxy war you see. The difficulty is that I think that when you're looking at what's happening in Yemen for a long time, you know, the Saudis were the crucial ally in fighting AQAP on the ground in Yemen. And I think they continue to play a very crucial role in that regard. But that has sort of morphed in over time into this sort of proxy conflict. Now, this proxy conflict will continue to go on and continue to morph in other directions. But there are still groups on the ground that are, you know, structurally aimed at trying to attack the West and trying to launch attacks against us here. And so having allies and relationships on the ground is going to continue to be very important. And the Saudis are clearly one of those. And so maintaining that relationship while, you know, it's getting embroiled in a very messy proxy war, and it probably will continue to be that. There is continually an enemy out there that we are trying to fight against, and you need someone to work with on the ground.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, Sir William Patey, and Raffaello Pantucci. Coming up next, two more of the crew of President Donald Trump's raft of the Medusa go semi-overboard, and New Zealand verges on complete civic collapse in a row over pizza toppings.
The Big Interview, the show that brings you the fascinating life stories of some of the most influential people in the world of art and culture, business and politics, continues this week with Kristin Scott Thomas.
We actors give the director and the editor and everyone else involved in the film and the making of the film sort of raw material to do their job with.
The Academy Award-nominated actress sits down with Robert Bound to discuss the creation of a character, why she managed to resist Hollywood directing her first film, and the unique demands of being an actress.
I was involved in this extraordinary film, which is having an extraordinary success, but then I had to keep talking about how wonderful and how cold it was in the desert at night and how wonderful it was to be working with Ralph Fiennes. And, you know, and it just got too much.
The Big Interview with Kristin Scott Thomas. Download it now at monocle.com.
Yeah. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Sir William Patey and Raffaello Pantucci. And let's look now at the latest development in the career of Steve Bannon, whose recent presence at the right hand of the President of the United States has inflamed a measure of consternation, especially among those who would prefer that such a position not be occupied by someone like Steve Bannon. Mr. Bannon now appears to have lost his spot on the National Security Council, and in semi-related news, House Intelligence Committee Chairman Devin Nunes has recused himself from the investigation into President Trump's connections with Russia on the grounds that he's under investigation himself. I'm not sure how much longer, frankly, my own will to live is going to hold up where the stories of these sorts are concerned, but still only 3 years and 10 months to go. Steve Bannon first. What has happened here? Do we know?
Well, he was always a strange choice for the National Security Council.
Very diplomatically put.
Yeah, he didn't have the traditional profile.
Again, this is what decades in the diplomatic service endows you with.
And originally he was there meant to be keeping an eye on Mike Flynn, the general.
Now that Mike, I guess with him gone, there's no job anymore.
Him gone, there's no job for Steve Bannon. But I know H.R. McMaster. I knew him in Afghanistan. He's a cerebral.
This is
thinking,
the new national security advisor,
and he's clearly trying to re-establish a normal National Security Council. Re-establishing the joint chiefs of staff was removed from it. The head of the CIA, the director of national intelligence, they're all now back on it.
Their removal is what a professional diplomat such as yourself would have called, I guess, innovative.
It was certainly innovative. and it may be that that Trump himself is beginning to realise that with the world as it is, you probably want a competent National Security Council to be giving you advice.
It's an idea, certainly. is that what is going on here, Raffaello? Does this look like Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster asserting himself, or normality as a whole asserting itself?
I think that's certainly what it feels like. I mean, I think that the appointment to Bannon this position was always very strange, and you know, it felt like a politicization of a structure which is supposed to be providing crucial intelligence on crucial national security questions to the president. To have a sort of national security advisor who comes in and kind of manages to clear that out and create it, return it to its sort of place that it should be, it does feel like him sort of stamping his authority on it. I think what's interesting is the question of what does this mean about Trump and how he's obviously changing. Is he changing his view of how he was going to govern? Is he shifting from thinking I'm going to continue to be this sort of insurgent in the White House to actually saying, okay, are we moving more towards normality now? And this sort of the brutal realization of what he's had to do or what he's got to take on is sort of sinking in. And so then you realize that actually you do need these sorts of structures around you. You can't just operate on this sort of, you know, wing and a prayer with a bunch of ideologues who are sort of dreaming about what could happen and, you know, talking these sort of extreme terms about getting rid of government altogether, that actually, if you're going to do something and achieve something, you really actually do need to be grounded. And, you know, bringing in H.R. McMaster is maybe the first indicator of moving in that direction. And, you know, maybe McMaster imposing his sort of authority on the National Security Council is further evidence of that taking place.
William, President Trump does clearly have a slightly childish fetish for senior military figures. He's very impressed by gold braid and medals. Might that actually end up being kind of a saving grace? He has, because of that, ended up appointing some fairly serious people to serious positions, not just McMaster as NSA, but James Mattis at Defense, Kelly at Homeland Security. Whatever reservations you might have about generals or ex-generals serving what's supposed to be a civilian government, might it not be the worst thing in the world?
No, and I think he has actually alighted on some of the, you know, the good generals, as it were. I mean, American generals, in my experience, who reach the very top, are usually very bright individuals, and the least, not particularly warlike. They're quite cerebral. So my experience in Iraq and Afghanistan of 3- and 4-star American generals is one that they're well suited to some of these positions. I think it's one of the reassuring things about Trump that he's managed to find some of these people to serve in his administration and hasn't gone across the board for people like Steve Bannon.
Raffaello, we should move on to Devin Nunes as well. It does seem slightly curious, all things considered, that he has clung on this long, but he has now recused himself. Now that makes, I'm trying to keep score over here, that makes Nunes and Jeff Sessions who've had to recuse themselves from the investigations. And that's on top of Flynn's resignation, which we discussed discussed earlier. Now, this is an extraordinary amount of smoke, but are we seeing any actual fire for sure yet?
I don't know that we necessarily are. It's a very confusing sort of picture because these people keep all stepping away from it. And we have all these accusations being thrown around, but it's all very kind of difficult to grasp exactly what this Russia connection is. I mean, we had that sort of document that came out, the famous Christopher Steele memo of what, 35 pages or whatever it was, with these very, you know, dramatic accusations. And then we've had all of these people sort of saying, oh, well, no, I can't be involved because I must, you know, step away from this investigation, these people walking away from it. And we kind of haven't got that middle bit, which is actually telling us what really happened. And that's what's really very confusing. You feel like there must be some sort of reality to all of this. But what exactly that is, I just don't know that we can confidently say, because it's so extreme on one end and so opaque on the other.
Well, finally tonight, we should move along to New Zealand, which teeters on the brink of appearance in international news programmes due to its Prime Minister's controversial views on pizza toppings. Bill English, for it is he's relatively new to the job, prompted widespread outrage by stating a preference for tinned spaghetti and pineapple on pizza, claiming it was a traditional recipe of his rural South Island childhood. It remains to be seen whether this will lead to a diplomatic incident, possibly, who knows, armed hostilities with Iceland, whose president, Gudni Johansson, has declared himself reasonably recently fundamentally opposed, that is a direct quote, to pineapple on pizzas. Now, Sir William, years, decades of professional diplomatic experience, you know, you have to call upon. How would you go about resolving this?
Well, I think the New Zealanders are able to call on their traditional allies, the Canadians, who invented the Hawaiian pizza with pineapple on it.
I remember
as a child, it was invented in the 60s, the Hawaiian pizza. I never liked it. I thought it was an abomination having pineapple on a pizza. But I'm not quite sure why it's suddenly become a big issue. It's been around for a while. Tinned spaghetti is probably goes beyond the pale, and I think the Italians may have something to say about this.
Tinned spaghetti was news to me, I have to say. Now, having grown up in Australia, I thought I was well attuned and well versed in the depravities and barbarities of our cousins across the Tasman, but I was not aware that even they would put tinned spaghetti on pizza. Raffaello, where are you on this? Do you have strong views on pineapple on pizza?
Pineapple on pizza, you know, I actually sometimes will not mind it that much. But as an Italian, of course, all of this is terrible, abominable activity, which is frankly hurting my very being if I think about it. The other practicality I was thinking was, wouldn't, if you dumped a sort of tin of spaghetti on a pizza, wouldn't it be really sloppy? I mean, how would it actually sort of hold together? Surely
presumably you spread it around with a spoon or something.
Right, possibly. But I mean, if you think of tinned spaghetti, it's got a lot of liquid in it, right?
Well, that was Bill English's defence. He said, it improves the liquid content of the pizza. You know, that was his defence.
Well, pizza isn't meant to be liquid. It's a solid thing. You
well,
know,
this is, unless he's thinking of the sort of tomatoey liquid around the tinned spaghetti as a substitute for the tomato puree or tomato spread that one might make.
But you only put a little bit of tomato spread on. I mean, if you're making a proper pizza, you really just have a sort of smear of that, not too much, and then the toppings lightly on top. And that's the right.
Sounds like a lot of carbohydrates to me.
It really does. So, but the question, there is also a serious strategic question here. I think I should probably put this to you, Raffaello, drawing on your experience at the Royal United Services Institute. If this does come to armed conflict between Iceland and New Zealand over this, where could they have it? Because the thing is that they both have very limited naval capacities, no air force to speak of. And I'm not really
look, I think
sure
given the foods we're talking about, it has to be hosted in Italy. You know, I think it's really that simple. The Italians would have to host it and frankly punish everyone when they get there, you know,
well, they
for
could have,
daring
they could,
to put all these things on a pizza in the first place.
So, it's a good idea. They could reopen the Colosseum and the Icelanders and New Zealanders could send their champions.
Exactly.
This is a brilliant idea. So that brings us to the question of who would win in a fight out of the New Zealanders and the Icelanders?
Well, I don't know. Some of these Maori rugby players and the Icelandic Vikings would be a pretty close call.
I think
it could be quite a dust-up, you know.
It would be a scrap worth watching. A final thought, then, on this, and we should defer to your expertise, Raffaello, as an actual Italian. Pizza, really. What should we be doing and not be doing? What are the red lines on what's absolutely forbidden, as far as you're concerned?
Well, I think anything from a tin, frankly, shouldn't be on a pizza. You know, so I think if it should be fresh, and that's kind of the end of it. You know, if you're putting stuff from a tin, it immediately adds a level of flavour which is really unpalatable. You can taste the sort of tinniness. It's not...
Well, on that uncompromising note, Raffaello Pantucci and Sir William Patey, thank you both very much for joining us at Midori House. The show was produced by Carlotta Ribello, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Alexis Sogol. Our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. Music next at 1900. Tom Edwards is in with The Urbanist. There's more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. I'll be your host for that as well. For now, I'm Andrew Mullett. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.